life is simpler after you retire, for some, it's actually more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors and an open forum for older adults with important questions about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome to another episode of Elder Talk. Susan Arthur. Today we're going to pick up, are we not, with where we left off with the last show?
We are, talking about long-term care.
Facilities. And this is a subject that I encourage you to stay tuned into, even if you in particular don't anticipate anytime soon going into long-term care. Now remember, long-term care refers, in the context we're using over these two shows, is primarily nursing homes, skilled care facilities. And many of us, if not for ourselves, will be dealing with such places for our loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
So the bottom line is, we think that this is a timely topic. This is a topic that's relevant to a lot of people either now or soon thereafter. And we want you to know that, believe it or not, there are lots of rights and assurances that residences and family members have regarding the quality of care and the quality of life that they're going to have in a long-term care facility. Many people assume that they're at the mercy of this institution, that perhaps they are not in a position to make any demands, that simply they should be thankful for what's there and not complain about whatever shortcomings there might be. And the reality is quite different.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to kind of do an update a little bit of what we covered last time. So those of you who are in on the last show, bear with me. I want to take a few minutes and let's do a refresher. We talked about the fact that what triggered this discussion was an update to the Nursing Home Reform Act. The Nursing Home Reform Act was originally passed in 1987. It was much needed. It came on the heels of some scandals and investigations in which it was determined that nursing homes were not providing the level of care that they should, that they were essentially warehousing old people until they died. And so suddenly there was a lot of attention. Spotlight was focused on this issue. Congress gets involved. And as part of the Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act of 1987, they passed the Nursing Home Reform Act. So this legislation has been in effect for 30 years. And even that we want to talk a little bit about, because there are assurances and rights that are provided in that legislation that many people do not know about. But what triggered our most recent discussion were updates to that law, updates that occurred in 2015, regulatory changes, the first substantial regulatory additions and changes that have occurred for 30 years to the Nursing Home Reform Act. And these are being implemented in three phases. Phase one was in 2016, November of 2016. Phase two was November of 2017. And then phase three was November of 2019. So the reason they phased these were because nursing homes need an opportunity to get up to speed to meet
right.
some of these requirements. Now, a recent update, I should tell you, is that because the nursing home industry, who has powerful lobbyists, I might add, importuned the Trump administration to essentially cut them some slack in terms of these deadlines, that the effect would be that they simply couldn't be profitable. And I don't want to be so cynical as a consumer to suggest that none of this is true. I can believe that these changes that might be required, some of which we'll talk about today, will place substantial budgetary demands on these facilities. And it may be that some perhaps will make it too costly to meet these regulatory demands. We all know that sometimes bureaucracies do that.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes regulations make it impossible for some businesses to survive. So in any case, the Trump administration has announced that there's an 18-month moratorium on enforcement of the segments, the phases that were required in 17 and then 19 as well. There will be a delay, not for the full 18 months, but whatever period would exist between then, at least 6 months. It doesn't mean that these provisions are not in effect. It means that the enforcement, the consequences of violation will not be imposed for those second two phases of requirements. So while consumer advocates in these areas, of course, are insistent that there be no delay, that the penalties be imposed immediately. As it stands right now, there is this this breathing period that has been extended for 18 months. And it again, it does not change the fact that these requirements are still there. So now, who do these laws apply to? Who does the what group of nursing homes does the National Nursing Home Reform Act, what group does that apply to, as well as these regulations? For the most part, these all apply to any nursing home or skilled care facility that's getting any sort of federal dollars. Now, that's going to include Medicaid. It's going to include Medicare and a few other care, Social Security and some other recipients of institutions. But the two primary ones and the ones governed by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which are essentially overseeing the enforcement and the compliance with these regulations, is going to be as it pertains to Medicare and Medicaid. It's the elephant in the room for virtually all of these facilities. It's the substantial majority of all skilled care facilities out there are receiving a lot of federal dollars. Mm-hmm. So they're interested in this compliance.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that we have talked about a little bit is we always want to kind of follow the money, and that's where the money is coming from. And so they do have a responsibility and an obligation to make sure that loved ones are being cared for properly.
Yeah, and I think that it's less about they're failing to meet these requirements than it is about many consumers, family members as well as the resident, not knowing that there's this obligation to comply. So if they don't insist on some of these things, maybe some of it isn't happening, whereas it otherwise happily would. The bottom line is, as I said last week, is that in this case, that old maxim that the squeaky wheel applies. I genuinely believe, and what I've witnessed with clients as well as friends and family, is that skilled care facilities are most attentive to those who are going to have family members and others looking over their shoulders and questioning and encouraging and even demanding things. That's the bottom line of how the world works as it pertains to long-term care facilities.
We talked last time about one of those things that you should ask about when you first go in and that you're entitled to is a care plan. And so that is something that just even asking the question lets the nursing home know or lets the long-term care facility know that you have looked into this, that you have done a little bit of your homework, and that you want to do what is best for your loved one.
Yeah, and in fact, that's a good segue to talking about some of the more recent changes. So among those things that have occurred since 2015 is a requirement about an assessment plan that has to be prepared within 48 hours. So within the time that a resident enters a facility, within 48 hours, it's called a resident assessment. That is something that must include information about the health history, information about doctor's orders, drugs. Now, this may seem routine to you, but I'm telling you that it's very common for such information about what drugs someone is taking or what drugs they've been told to take, medications. That information may come in dribs and drabs over days, if not, dare I say, a week plus when people come into these facilities. Historically, this has happened. What the Nursing Home Reform Act wants to assure is that information is there virtually immediately so that there's no misstepped or missed occasions when there should have been medication provided. And this has just been a routine problem historically.
Well, and I can think how easy it would be for an older adult to have their medication and their routine is mixed up. They forgot that they took this one. I've talked to some people that have pages of medication that they take each and every day at particular times. And it's just doesn't always get communicated in an effective way from the patient themselves.
Yeah, and really it's about a handoff. You know, it's about the effectiveness of a handoff. And in this case, the handoff may not be literally from one medical provider to another, meaning the skilled care facility as the receiver. But instead, it's perhaps is them simply operating on their own at home in some fashion, whether it's regimented or not, and then suddenly that care has been handed over specifically to this facility. So in either case, it's a handoff, and that handoff has to be smooth, and all too often, historically, it's not been. And similar things about the resident assessment. The resident assessment needs to know all those fundamental things that are going to be important for the care, in the short term at least, of this patient. What else would they need to include in those files? They include in files the medical history, the family. There should have been interviews with the family about the expectations for the patient. Now, maybe not the sort of discussions about purpose and goals that we'll come to in just a minute when we talk about the comprehensive plan. But the assessment is supposed to be all that information that allows them to be up and running very quickly to providing the quality of care that person needs and should have. Now, this, though, is the prelude to what must be completed within 7 days of the resident assessment. And that's the comprehensive person-centered care plan. I'm using a phrase from the new legislation, the new regulations, person-centered.
And that's certainly a different perspective than nursing facility centered.
It is. It is. It's not institutional.
Right.
It sounds almost like a concierge sort of mm-hmm. concept. And what it reflects, this whole idea of a comprehensive care plan generally, is the idea that you want to think now about what are the goals of this individual, not this old person that we have to provide the fundamentals for life, but instead, what are the goals of this resident in terms of the balance of their life? Is their intention to go home? Is that a realistic expectation? Mm-hmm. Some people come in, believe it or not, and they understand that they're not likely to go home, and that's a different way to approach their care. But the point is, they're making that decision versus the person who may come in and have a different idea. And even if they have a different idea, there has to be discussion about whether or not that's realistic.
So if your goal is to return home, but your doctor says that's probably not going to happen, the nursing home needs to be aware of that, and they need to work with you toward reaching some sort of an attainable goal.
Right. And here, that's a good example. So under the new regs, what I would expect to happen is, in the comprehensive care plan, in addition to all that more hard data that you'd expect to find there, which all needs to be there, meaning thorough historical information, things that would go beyond what was in simply the resident assessment that is prepared in that very early period, very quickly when you enter the facility. But after a week or so, it's expected that you're to have dug deeply and found out a lot more of the quantitative stuff, meaning accumulating records from doctors going back a period of time, having a team, that sort of team approach, other physicians who will evaluate as the information might require certain areas of need, other specialists, et cetera. So using that team approach, they will know a lot more for purposes of the comprehensive care plan than, of course, they knew for the resident assessment. But among the things that, in this example here, where we're talking about the soft stuff, it's some of the phraseology that's used is quality of care and quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
And this would probably fall into the category of quality of life, meaning thinking about goals and objectives. You know, what are your values? What do you want to see happen? Treating you with the dignity of being a person. And in this case, where the person may say, I really expect, and I think it's realistic, and I want to go home. I'd like that to be the plan. You know, whether it's a week, a month, likely not a week, depending on the nature of the issue. But the point is, that may be expressed clearly by a resident. So the doctor may say, I'm skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens under the new quality of life sort of quality of care approach is that the nursing home should dignify your request and say, okay, in order for that to happen, these specific things need to be achieved over the next 3 to 4 weeks. And those will be clear, tangible goals, whether it's of a rehabilitative type, or whether it's a response in terms of a cardiac condition, mm-hmm. maybe some level of improvement. But it's not simply being condescending and patting them on the head and say, yes, yes, we'll see. We may be able to do that
right someday.
Instead, it's dignifying the request and talking about these are the things that we would like to see and must see if it's going to be realistic for you to safely go home.
So would that then maybe include some of those activities of daily living that we talked about, where there are certain criteria, if you cannot do them, that makes you eligible for long-term care. If you can do them, that perhaps means that you may be able to go home.
Yeah, it could be functional. That's a good example of functional requirements. You know, you have to be able to do certain things to be able to afford people who can do those things in your home. And other things are more physiological. Maybe there's an infection. Maybe there's some other neurological condition, whatever it might be. But the whole idea is, and these things are audited, the whole idea now is that CMS is saying, we want to see you up your game. It's good what you did after 87.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen huge progress. We're not seeing infections, for the most part, left unattended. We're not seeing people lying in fecal matter like mm-hmm. they did at one time.
Mm-hmm.
We're not seeing the abuses that we saw at one time. Not that those things have been eliminated entirely, but there's been huge progress. But now the bar's been raised, and it's about the intangibles as well. And these things will be audited periodically. And furthermore, to the extent that you as consumers listening to this show, to the extent that you file a complaint, which there's a hotline, an elder abuse hotline. There's a CMS hotline, which you can go to cms.gov mm-hmm. and find out that information. But the bottom line is that you can report these things, and there will be follow-up, and there will be consequences. And the worst of which is that they would lose their certification to receive federal dollars, which is huge.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a terminal outcome for some facilities. In any case, so what they were saying now is that we want you to document nursing homes, document that you've complied with these timelines, and show us where you've developed these very personal, individualized plans about what these people value, what are their particular preferences. Preferences also, individual preferences, not institutionally imposed decisions, are important. It might affect the type of food you have, where you want to go. Do you want to try to go to a religious service on Sunday or Saturday, as the case may be? And that's typically realistic, unless, of course, you're confined due to medical conditions. But absent that, skilled care facilities are expected to provide a residential environment that is welcoming, that is individualized, that attends to your other needs. And there's even now discussion of the standard that's been imposed. And I had with me a quote here that let me see if I can find it, that this is really the standard that nursing homes are held to now. And I'm quoting here. Each resident must receive and the facility must provide the necessary care and services to attain or maintain the resident's highest practicable physical, mental, and psychosocial well-being, consistent with the resident's comprehensive assessment and plan of care. So that's a mouthful.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a handful. I mean, it's not easy to meet these requirements. Think about it. The highest practicable. Practicable means it's stronger than practical. It's saying, is it realistically possible? Not is it just realistic, but is it realistically possible? So it's a little bit of a more demanding word than to say the highest practical physical. So the highest practicable physical, mental, and psychosocial. The psychosocial piece is probably, among those words, the psychosocial piece has probably received more attention in these latest regulations that separates it most prominently from those of 87 versus 2015.
Yeah, it seems like these new regulations really have expanded upon what was done in 1987. What 1987 really took care of some of those really obvious and egregious mistakes. And so we've had 30 years of having those implemented, really doing a much better job of caring for people. But this is taking it to that next level.
It is. And you know, it should be. Now that we recognize demographically, there's this groundswell, some would say a tsunami almost, of people who are going to be hitting these skilled care facilities statistically. Statistically now, if you're 65 or older, there's a greater than a 40% chance, I think it's like 42-43% chance, that you'll spend some period of time in one of these facilities. So of those of you who are listening to me, especially if you're 65 or older, which I assume is the majority of people listen to this show, there's more than a 40% chance that you're going to spend some period of time in one of these facilities. So you should know what your rights are.
Well, and if it's not you, you may be younger than that. You may think, I'm never going to do that. But it could be a loved one. You know, we have watched over the last year, the loved ones in our family, they have their health has changed. And so they are moving next weekend to a facility that they can do the continuum of care because they may not be asking those questions, but we need to, as their advocates, help them ask those questions.
And so we want to arm you with the information you need to accomplish that. So we talked last time about notification of changes. This is big. This means that any significant change in a person's condition requires immediate notification of a family member, unless that's forbidden, of course, by the resident. The resident, remember, is the one who we're honoring here with dignity. So if they didn't want anybody contacted, so be it. In that case, they're to be informed. But the bottom line is, let's assume the resident, the family, as well as the physician, is to know immediately of any significant change. What might that be? What about an accident that occurred? It could be simple. It could be that simply their heel, they're wearing a sock, their heel came out from under them. Maybe they fell. Maybe it didn't seem to amount to much. I can tell you 20 years ago, that wouldn't have been reported.
Oh, right.
Even after 1987, I don't think that would have been reported for the most part. Now, that is significant as defined by these regs. So that's the sort of thing that would require notifying the family. Now, maybe it happens at 2 in the morning. You may not get a call at 2 in the morning, depending on if it was a good fall. I mean, if it was a significant fall. A change in their mental or physical condition of any sort that's significant could be simply a confrontation with a fellow resident that resulted in a scene of some sort. Maybe they felt upset, maybe they're traumatized by it, and that's the sort of thing that should require notification of the family. Change in any of lab tests, if there's any significant change in lab tests, doctors to be notified immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with family members. So this is a much higher bar than many people have come to expect, and I can tell you that unless with some skilled care facilities, and I don't want to paint with too broad a brush this discussion, because there are many wonderful ones, but there are a lot of them who are not so diligent on these details. And you need perhaps to step forward as a family member or a resident and insist on this level of diligence. Safe environment. Now, that doesn't sound new, but it does mean that now it includes a clean, comfortable, and I'm quoting here, home-like environment. So to the extent that some facilities have not renovated, they've not been updated yet, now the pressure is on them to update their facilities and to accommodate these new standards.
Yeah, gone are the days of the sterile, everything being white and tile and all of that kind of decor.
Yeah. And we talked, let me look at some of the quality of life things we talked about quite a bit. But remember that can include a lot of stuff. And that can include, for example, ensuring that the resident's abilities to engage in activities, we talked about the activities of daily living, their ability to be engaged, to be challenged so that they don't degenerate. One of the requirements is that they not diminish unless it is impossible to avoid. I think the word used is impracticable to avoid. They are to maintain their same, at a minimum, their same level of functionality. Now, we know that as a practical matter, as we age, that may not be possible. But you can see how the spotlight is on the facility to account for a diminution in this functionality.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to explain it if it happens. So even though it might be expected, even by the family, they're supposed to provide activities that preserve the activities of daily living functionality. And that can mean games, it can mean going somewhere, it can mean trips, those who can leave the facility, it can mean trips.
Several places have little exercise groups or they'll do get-togethers for Zumba or Wii bowling is another one I've heard a lot of people doing and a lot of nursing homes working on the Wii.
Oh, yeah, and it's a marvelous thing.
Uh-huh.
And virtual stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's ironic that the virtual stuff is actually more compatible sometimes with the very old than with the very young. And especially when you don't have to really learn how to operate it per se.
Right.
But another thing is psychosocial. big emphasis on that in the new regs. So this means that people are not to be isolated unless they make a decision. Remember, it's all about respecting. So they're not drug into a group setting. If they choose to be alone, they can, but they're to be strongly encouraged to participate so that they don't decline at the rate that notoriously people who spend a lot of time alone, they're far more vulnerable to declining. So the facility needs to stretch to assure that these psychosocial skills are met. And if your loved one is not interacting a lot, if he or she seems isolated, I'm going to jump to the conclusion that it's a failure of the nursing home to meet this requirement.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm being unfair, but until they explain it, I would make that assumption.
Well, I will just share a personal story. We have some friends whose mother was in a facility, and probably not a great one, in Florida. And they told her she has dementia, she has cognitive issues, and there's nothing we can do. And the son and his wife said, nope, that's not acceptable. She is a nurse. They took her home, and that was 10 years ago. She has declined, but she's 90-something now. They got her up. She'd go to the senior center. Doesn't always want to, per se, but they're keeping her active. They're keeping her there, and she has lived much longer, and they have enjoyed the company with her.
90-something?
90-something. She's about 93, I believe. And 10 years ago, the nursing home said, well, sorry, there's nothing we can do. And they had her just not in a good place. And they, like I said, the son and his wife said, no, we're not going to stay with that. And made some big changes. I mean, certainly before these changes were enacted that we've been discussing, but they took it upon themselves. And like I said, they have enjoyed 10 more years with his mother.
Yeah. And does anyone doubt that you can take someone and place them, isolate them in a vegetative facility,
mm-hmm.
and that would not significantly reduce their lifespan, even if their fundamental physical requirements are being met.
Mm-hmm.
They're getting food,
right.
They're getting water, they're getting their meds, but we all know it's not enough. And this Obama era reform. Where they've added a new set of regulations is really about, you know, it's not enough to meet those physical things. Yes, you need to do that, and we've talked some about that, and that too is addressed, incidentally, in some ways with this newer legislation or regulations. But a good 75% of it, maybe I should say 2/3 of it, is relating to things that are less tangible.
And that is what makes each one of us unique. We all need food, clothing, and shelter, but what makes me different than someone else and me important to my kids or my family members are the things that we're discussing, the dignity, the who I am, what do I like, what do I not like, and those don't go away just because you're older and aging.
No, they don't. And let's talk about some of the things that might be evidence of a lack of diligence and things that the regulations would intend to forbid. Let's go down. Quality of care. We'll focus on quality of care and talk about a few topics. One is skin integrity. It's called now, incidentally, rather than bed sores, you're supposed to use the phrase pressure ulcers.
Oh.
That's what's used in the regs, pressure ulcers. But we all know what that is. And that's where your skin has been in contact, where there's been pressure on the skin. And as a result, it reduces the blood flow, which means it gets less oxygen. And as a result, it's more vulnerable to developing sores,
mm-hmm.
To lesions, and then a shearing effect when you move it, you know, when you move it along a surface. So we know that the parts of the bodies like the buttocks and the hips and the heels are notorious spots for those things to develop. When someone has those, it's a red flag, that they've not gotten the attention that they probably should have gotten. And again, I'm choosing my words carefully. It's not conclusive evidence, mm-hmm. but it's suggestive.
They're fairly preventable. I mean, not completely, but they are fairly preventable.
That's right. And so that's the sort of thing you shouldn't be seeing with your loved one. If you are, you deserve an explanation. And incidentally, that too should be reported. That's an example of something. You should get a phone call if you're a loved one. The doctor should be notified. So in other words, people are being brought in with the information about this to where if it's not right, there's a better opportunity of getting it corrected. As it relates to the nursing home too. Accidents. Not that a nursing home is conclusively responsible, but when you have an accident such as a fall, and falls are one of the greatest causes of injury mm-hmm. in any facility for the elderly. A fall, the two big dangers are fractures, especially hip fractures, and cognitive or neurological damage if their head hits the floor in any way.
Mm-hmm.
So falls kind of occur in two categories, assisted and unassisted. An unassisted fall is where the person kind of gets up at night and they just, maybe they're walking in the dark and they fall down. That suggests that there was not a proper things in place. It's not conclusive, but it does suggest that perhaps there should have been, if the person was prone to wander, we talked about that the last show,
mm-hmm.
where people are prone to simply, they get up and they wander about. They may not know where they are. They may be dreaming. But people who have any history at all of that, there's so much technology and so many ways to anticipate that behavior or to prevent that behavior. There are solutions to that. So if your loved one has gotten up in a long-term care facility and has fallen, you should be asking questions about how that happened. And incidentally, you should have gotten a phone call when it did happen. Now, what about assisted? It seems mm-hmm. like a contradiction of terms, an assisted fall. But that's really, it probably is a good portion of the time it happens that way. And I even remember when I was in undergrad, I was working as a orderly in a hospital trying to pay my way through undergrad. And so I saw some of this happen. I mean, what did I know back then? But we're trying to help somebody get out of bed. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're way overweight. Maybe we should have waited for three more people to help. And that's generally what the underlying problem is that there should have been more people there when these falls occur.
Mm-hmm.
But assisted falls are very common. And it's where usually the problem is, if it's investigated, was that someone went ahead and acted and didn't have enough people there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in my case, I never saw an injury result, but the point is it could very well have. And this is an example of the thing that the regulations require the appropriate people to be there and for these incidents to not occur. And they'll go into the file when they do happen. Incontinence, another issue. I mean, the things that can flow from that if it's not addressed,
right.
So to speak. if it's not addressed, the infections, sepsis.
Mm-hmm.
Sepsis, incidentally, is one of the huge problems that threaten people's lives in long-term care facilities as well as even hospitals, and that's where. I don't understand it completely, but it's where, for example, you had a urinary tract infection, very common, where there's a catheter and
right.
it's not been cleaned regularly, or where there's another sore and some sort of lesion. And an infection sets in, and then the body senses this infection in the blood, and so the body initiates an inflammatory response. So it really attacks itself. It's a system-wide inflammatory response. So it can shut down organs. Mm-hmm. I mean, it can very quickly lead to death.
It does.
And that's and so
and young people as well. So certainly an older person who has a more compromised immune system to begin with.
Oh, yeah.
Is definitely at a higher risk for that.
So sepsis is lurking, you know, sort of in the background whenever you have any failure on the part of a long-term care facility to follow up very quickly. And the regs are very clear about the diligence that's required in their follow-up regarding these things. Nutrition, hydration, bed rails. There are rules, and I think these rules actually fall under the rules relating to abuse, neglect, and exploitation. Hmm. That's a phraseology for a section. Abuse, neglect, and exploitation. And now abuse is defined as something that's willful. Now I think that's occurring less often,
mm-hmm.
where there's some willful confinement that's included as abuse. Hmm. So where someone's confined willfully. An example of that, though, of it may be considered negligent, but it could be considered abuse where someone has bed rails or other restraints in which they're perhaps tied down. Now the rules are very clear. The regs state someone cannot be tied down unless it is directly required for their medical care. It cannot occur because of the convenience of the facility.
Mm-hmm.
They make that very clear.
Very clear.
And certainly not as punishment. That's mentioned as well. Because sometimes people will be threatened that, you know, if you wander down the hall and you cause us problems, we're going to tie you down.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have happened routinely 20, 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's a violation. It's a violation of the rules. It's a violation of the CMS rules for a facility receiving federal benefits. Bed rails, too. I wasn't aware of this until I started reading these regs. But apparently bed rails are a big health and safety threat.
Oh, really?
Oddly enough, you'd think it would make it safe.
But because they can't get out in an emergency or
well,
why?
Well, don't get me wrong. There are occasions when a bed rail may make sense. But there's a heavy burden on the facility if they decide to use them. And there are occasions where it may make sense. Don't get me wrong. But generally speaking, the rules are that, based on research, that bed rails result in people climbing over them, trying to get around them. They fall. There have been cases where people strangle on the wires the tubes
mm-hmm.
the tubes that may be attached to them. There have been a number of injuries and mishaps associated with bed rails. So now the regs state that if bed rails are to be used, it has to be specifically required for medical condition. They're to explain these to the patient. And if the patient, unless they have dementia or something, and the patient is to consent to these.
Hmm, okay.
So it's a whole new ballgame.
It is.
Regarding the quality of care. Should we take a quick break before we talk about these other things?
We should. We need to. We're running short of time anyway.
Okay. Back in a moment.
Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors, presented by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors, and now attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Okay, we're back with Elder Talk. Let's continue our discussion here. We only have less than 10 minutes left, so I guess we got to talk fast. So I want to come back though to alternatives that are available instead of, for example, bed rails and people being tied down and other restraints that would have been permitted some time ago and are now discouraged or forbidden under these new regs. And, for example, a care plan. If they know someone is vulnerable to a fall, for example, common solutions might be more supervision, a room near the nurse's station, bed and chair alarms, floor mats, motion sensor alarms. I mean, all this technology is available. And you can even put the bed closer to the ground would be an option.
Oh, yeah.
So the bottom line is when they come in, remember this care plan we talked about that's to take place, and you're entitled to ask to see that, assuming you have a consent order by the resident or you're otherwise a holder of a durable power of attorney
for health care
that gives you access to that, then you should be able to see it in the care plan where there was some effort to identify the fall risk. And that means thinking about how vulnerable someone is to a fall. And there could be a number of solutions to that, including they have things like Hoyer lifts and sit to stand. But more common than anything else, as we mentioned a few moments ago, is the failure to provide adequate staffing. And if there's a single complaint that has emerged from these new regs, is that nursing homes are saying to the Trump administration and others that these requirements are going to require staffing levels and ratios that they cannot afford to meet. And it's true that these things we've talked about today do require that you have more people doing more things.
They certainly do. If you look at some of these regulations, all of them or most of them require more people to monitor, more people to pay attention, more people to help lift, more people to make sure you get your medications on time. And so there is that tension between having a nursing facility and a long-term care facility be profitable and around sustainable, and yet providing the type and the level of care that is needed and necessary.
But I do prefer, if they're going to err on one side or the other, I prefer they err on the side of over care for the resident. And in these rules, another common denominator is there's a lot more documentation required. This documentation we just mentioned, where they have to do an assessment of the fall risk of somebody that comes in. You should see that in the paperwork. That requires time, not just to write it down, but to do the assessment.
Mm-hmm.
And also similarly, the rules require that there be a determination of the risk that someone is going to develop something like a pressure ulcer that we talked about a while ago. They have to do an evaluation, which means there's this scale. I think it's called a Braden scale for predicting pressure. It's a scale that nurses are to use, in which they evaluate an incoming resident and then periodically thereafter to identify in advance proactively their vulnerability to this sort of injury. And there are strategies, meaning if you take the time in the assessment that's now required, then you can develop a strategy which needs to be included in the comprehensive care plan, a strategy that might include more turning and repositioning than they'd otherwise do, maybe being very vigilant about the nutrition and hydration, which incidentally is also a factor in what we'll call bed sores. Adequate nutrition, wheelchair cushions, mm-hmm. those egg crate. I guess those are still around. It's a special mattress.
Yeah,
that you can put down that again reduces it. Heel boots. I mean, heel boots are a thing that you commonly see in with people who are vulnerable to that. And then just generally, you know, the staff to monitor the skin condition.
Right.
So these are all things that, as a family, or as a resident, you're entitled now to expect, but more so than simply because it's reasonable and it's fair, now it's a rule. Now mm-hmm. it's a regulation that the CMS is insisting on. So I know that we're running out of time here, so we can't talk in detail, but I can tell you that there are a lot of rules that the nursing home or long-term care facilities are having to deal with that they didn't at one time. It does create a better, safer, more healthy, mentally mm-hmm. healthy environment than existed before. But it's only good if you take the time to gain some familiarity with these rules. You don't have to become a lawyer on this topic, but you need to do a little research. Go online and look up the Nursing Home Reform Act, and I'm sure you'll find a number of places where they talk about what your rights and expectations are and should be. So,
well, and as we start to close it out, we kind of circle back around to where we started. Is it's okay to ask the questions. You don't have to be a bully, but it's okay to intervene and to intercede for your loved one. Ask those questions. Ask them, well, I didn't get a call when they fell. Can you explain a little bit more about that for me? Or to be their advocate, really.
Yeah, or my mother has a bed sore. Has there been a plan in place? Did you identify her vulnerability to that?
Mm-hmm.
She had had one 5 years ago. Do you have a care plan that reflects you doing the evaluation when they came in? And did you develop a plan at that time for her care? And has it been followed? And if it has been followed, why does she have a bed sore now?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the sort of proactive, engaged participation
right.
that will result in you and a loved one getting much better care.
Well, and as we said earlier, that doesn't necessarily mean that the nursing facility was at fault.
Right.
But you can at least ask the question and do a little bit more investigation.
Yes. Trust, as I think as Kissinger said, trust but verify.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, I guess with that, we'll have to wrap this up. So this has been another episode of Elder Talk. Until next week, take care.
You've been listening to Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, sponsored by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. For more information, visit eldercarelaw.com. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.